The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. In a time when the world realized just how fragile it is, author and archaeologist Mark Olley's new book, Crystal Skulls and Human Heads, brings a different view of what it means to be human, what the planet really is, how extinction is simply a part of nature, and how the whole of life we so comfortably fit into may not be quite what it seems. From the muddled history of crystal skulls, to the falls of ancient civilizations and epoch-defining cataclysmic events, myself and Mark look at hidden histories and new discoveries to consider that things are never as cut and dried as some may wish us to believe. Mark certainly takes us out of our comfort zone on this week's show. Before that though, don't forget you can support Mysteries and Monsters by going up to Patreon. You can find us at patreon.com/mysteriesandmonsters or click on the link in the show notes as usual. $4 a month gets you ad-free episodes, guaranteed early releases, and bonus content. You can also find Mysteries and Monsters across all social media platforms. Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn, and please subscribe to our channel on YouTube. You can also go to mysteriesandmonsters.com for episodes, news, and merchandise. Thank you as always to Dean Bestel for his marvellous artwork. The show is produced by Brennan Storr of the Ghost Story Guys, and Mysteries and Monsters is delighted to be a part of the Straight Up Strange Network. I recently joined Craig Bryant, my guest on the previous show, to dive into some of Sheffield's most notable hauntings and ghost stories, so you can find that by looking for Paranormal Pendle Podcast, where all good podcasts live. So, let's join Mark Olley to consider the possibilities of what the human race has the potential to achieve, and much more. Today, I'm joined by archaeologist, author, musician, and television presenter, Mark Olley. In Mark's latest book, Crystal Skulls and Human Heads, he invites the reader to look at the history of mankind and consider the reality of what we think we know, and to open our minds to the real potential we all have hidden inside. Mark, welcome to Mysteries and Monsters.
Thank you for having me. It's nice to be here.
Oh, absolute pleasure, Mark. It's always nice to speak to a fellow Brit.
Excellent. Yeah, I've been doing a lot of talking to the Americans in the recent months. Yeah, definitely. It's nice to be back on home turf. And in fact, this is probably the first home turf interview I've done, I think, relating to the book. So you have yourself an exclusive. There you have it.
Fabulous. That's what we like to hear. And we'll try and not drop into any local colloquialisms as we're chatting, since we're not too far away. I think we must be about 60 miles apart at the moment.
Yeah, you're on one side of the Pennines. I'm on the other, and it's chances are it's raining on both.
Yeah, it's kind of calmed down here. We had a bit of sun yesterday. That'll do for a week.
Oh, you sent it over here then.
As always, in Cheshire, you're based in is a place very close to my heart. I had family that lived in Cheshire, so I know Nantwich and Cheshire and Chester and all in between, all around. So it's a beautiful county in the country.
Well, if anyone's listening internationally, the easy way to locate where I am, I'm exactly the same distance from Liverpool and Manchester, right in the middle. That's where I am. So easy to find.
Absolutely. Always confuses Southerners, Mark, when they don't understand that area, because they don't understand why some people have a Scouse twang and some people have a Mancunian twang.
Yeah. And then there's one or two others knocking around just to, you know, throw in the mix. Warrington's quite unique. We have a pretty much no accent that you can really discern. Mm. If you're a true Warringtonian, which I am, because I mean, I've lived here my entire life. So, you know, I am what Warrington is, I suppose.
Mm. But, yeah. Fantastic. Well, Mark, you're someone with a long history and a very varied career in a variety of wonderful aspects to it. So you are someone with a deep knowledge and love of the subject of archaeology. Was this, because obviously in this day and age, it's not really the kind of subject that people tend to sort of get fired up by. But I think because we're quite similar ages, we lived through that period, sort of the end of the 70s and the 80s, where archaeology became really cool, thanks to Indiana Jones.
Well, yeah. And the industry itself went through a revolution. In fact, it went through several revolutions. I started off, I was only 8 years old. My dad was a volunteer digger for the local history society and what have you, which in the 1950s, 1960s, when he was doing it, and into the 1970s, it wasn't an industry. It wasn't a discipline. It didn't really exist. You know, it was all done using volunteers and very much ad hoc, you know, and done as it went along. So I started at the end of the 1970s. And 8 years old, I was dumped into this massive Roman site, because we've got Wilderspool here at Warrington. I was dumped into that, and then I just got hooked, absolutely hooked on it. So really then, right the way through, when I finished at art college in the late 70s, opposite Warrington Art College is the Warrington Museum. So I went across there and I started training with Liverpool under a couple of really, really famous archaeologists that were teaching at Liverpool at the time. And basically, I stuck with it. I stuck with it till I got a record deal in the 1980s, because I went off into the music business. But again, that's the kind of business that takes you everywhere. So you're going all around the country, you're going to other countries, you know. So the archaeology, the history just grew and grew and grew and grew. So in the 1990s, when I retired from the music business, late 1990s, I came back. But as you rightly say, by the time it got into the late 1990s, it had changed. You know, you'd got Time Team, you'd got all the Indiana Jones movies, you'd got Tomb Raider, for goodness sake.
Yeah,
there weren't many diggers that looked like that on my dig sites, but, you know, you've got all that sort of thing going on, and it's like, wow, this is absolutely amazing. So obviously I did the cool thing. I came back at the right moment. We did the 1990s, went into the 2000s. 2005, we did Lost Treasures for ITV, which is absolutely brilliant, superb series, really groundbreaking, loads of stuff. But then eventually that fizzled out because Time Team came to an end, and obviously that series came to an end in 2008. It was still on Sky up to about 2011. And then nowadays, everything's kind of gone back to being fairly tame. Mm. You know, the archaeology now is part of the building trade, mostly. That's where all the money and the impetus is coming from. The volunteer diggers now have all but died out. There's one or two societies still around, but, you know, not many. And it's just different. So hence the fact I'm writing more books now than I am digging things up. But, you know, I still find stuff. There's still people reporting finds. There's still things out there. Once you get into it, it follows you. You know, it doesn't go away. It's like this little dog that you try and shake, you know, and get rid of. It's always coming after you, and you sympathise with it all the time, and then you start feeding it, and it grows into a monster. And that's kind of how archaeology has been for me. It's sometimes it's been there, sometimes it's not been there, but it's always followed me. You know, the fascination's always followed me. Hence, that leads into the writing of the book, I suppose.
Absolutely. I mean, it is interesting as well, touching on archaeology as well, because obviously that's something that's very close to where I am in Sheffield here, because there's been a big furore about Sheffield University closing their archaeology department, Mark, which a lot of people have found quite scandalous. And I find it quite odd. Without saying I'm an expert, I'm one of those people, I have a deep fascination with history and archaeology especially. And I often find it remarkable, as you say now, that we've kind of gone full circle to where we were sort of in the mid-70s.
Yeah.
The vast majority of archaeological finds these days seem to be accidental, which is what seemed to be happening sort of in the 70s and early 80s. And then obviously you had your serious digs and projects and things going on. And it's a real shame for me, because when you look at what's been discovered and these accidental discoveries that came along and things that get found, some of the most famous discoveries are often things where people have been, farmers have been ploughing their fields and turned something up, or metal detectorists have stumbled across massive hoards of old money and swords and shields and all sorts. So for you, as someone with a deep love of this subject, do you find it frustrating that it seems to be mothballed again?
Well, in a word, yes. I mean, the big frustration for me here was when they closed. I mean, Liverpool faded out a long time ago, but they only fairly recently shut Manchester. Mm. Greater Manchester Archaeology Unit, that's closed. So obviously a lot of the people we work with on Lost Treasures, a lot of my friends and people I've been working with for many years were there. That's gone. Unfortunately, they've managed to save some of it, and it's become independent now. But I think the gist of it is that the money is just not there now in the educational field to fund it in the way that it used to be funded. And when you say accidentally find stuff, you're right in a way, because it's builders and developers who are then paying for archaeologists to go on to building developments and stuff. And that's where all the stuff's coming from now. That's where it's turning up. Although I do have to say, there is still, as you say, people's back gardens, farmers, metal detectorists, people who are working, you know, on the coast, divers, people like that. People that are out there doing things are still finding stuff. It's still happening.
Yeah, it's strange for me. I know, like you were saying about when you've done work with television, and obviously Time Team is probably the most famous example here in the UK of a well-established show fully based on archaeology, Mark.
Yeah.
I find it odd that these things drop out of fashion, and then 3 or 4 years later, something else slightly similar turns up. And I know there's one at the minute that was on, I think it started last year with Hugh Dennis, and they were basically going around people's houses saying, can we dig your back garden up? And I don't understand it. Programs like the two you worked on, they are wildly popular. I know the Smithsonian Channel did a series a couple of years ago with Clive Anderson, Mystic Britain, that was going around and looking at these historical artifacts. I can't get my head around why things, they do these shows, they're very popular, and then they just go, oh, well, people don't like that anymore. But people still watch them. So it's clear that the British public have a deep love and fascination with this subject, regardless of what producers might think.
That's absolutely true. There is this maxim in television, though, within the industry, where if you go to get something commissioned, if you go to a commissioner and you say, you know, here's my TV program, what they tend to do is they tend to have this maxim, which is the same but different. So that's why you get like the same, which is whatever the programs have been in the past, but then you have to do the same but different. You've got to do something different with it. So Lost Treasures, I think, absolutely knocked them sideways, because it was completely different. There was nothing out there at all that was even vaguely like that in 2005. But then when that hit the screens, it was, immediately popular with a huge, huge viewership. I think one episode, the one we did on Pendle and the Witches, it was the highest viewed episode of any program that night on any channel. And there were 600,000 viewers tuned in. You know, it was only on for half an hour, but wow, you know, we just pulled everybody in. It's also the only program in ITV Granada history to be voted the best one on television by all 12 of the public review panel members. So we absolutely rocked it. I think we hit the peak with what we were doing with Lost Treasures. But then, as you say, it had a shelf life. You know, we had 3 seasons. We had 6 episodes, 8 episodes, and 8 episodes over 4 years. And then they stopped. It was like, yeah, thanks, lads. That's it. So like you say, I don't see the logic in that. If something's going to run and run. But then I suppose, you know, there's always this possibility that they might bring something back, like you say. I am in negotiation to try and take that particular, the Lost Treasures franchise, to another channel that does it digitally. So I'm in the middle of that at the moment. If that comes off, that will be amazing, because obviously the viewers will have something that they can go back to, as it were. But at the moment, you know, the whole thing's just, it's been mothballed for about the last 10 years or so. So it'd be nice to bring it back, nice to do something with it.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, you only look at Time Team, for example, which I believe has now gone onto YouTube and is entirely funded by its viewership, which I think when you're looking at this kind of aspect and what you're referring to there, clearly because there is the appetite for it, and obviously the whole way people digest information and entertainment these days, Mark, has so changed in the last 20 years. It's remarkable, really, when you sit down and think about it. Clearly, a lot of places and a lot of the old guard, as it were, in regards to these channels, seem to be kind of programs and subjects seem to be falling through the cracks. And then they go online and they just find often they find a bigger audience because they're not restricted by a country's channels.
Yeah, they become international. We rather cleverly did the opposite. We did the reverse because at the time, obviously, you had Time Team when we were doing producing Lost Treasures in 2005. And Time Team, there was this joke, you know, where it took them an hour to find a few small walls and a few scraps of pottery, which, you know, in the modern day and age, you know, that kind of meticulous program building is not really what the public were looking for. So what we did with Lost Treasures, we actually made it like, very much like an internet YouTube show, where, you know, you literally had visual and audio bites. You had, you know, chunks in the program that held your attention for, you know, however many minutes, and then moved on, because you only had half an hour. There was only actually 27 minutes in that with adverts that was usable, so it was incredibly fast moving. All the topics linked together and the shows held together extremely well. But we made a TV show for terrestrial television in the same way as other people were producing things for online. So we shook it up, you know, we altered the way things were done. And it worked tremendously well. I've not actually seen anybody else do that since. A lot of the programs on archaeology now that are there on terrestrial are still very slow. You know, they might only deal with like an object every 10 minutes or whatever. The BBC are notorious for doing things like that, where they'll go, oh, here is a Celtic shield, you know, and then you'll spend like 5 or 10 minutes with reconstructions, you know, computer graphics, the dating analysis. And, but I mean, if we'd have found a Celtic shield or something like that, you'd have probably got 2 or 3 minutes and then wham, you're off to something else, you know, straight away. Oh, and we made all the episodes like mini movies as well. We said, well, if they can do it in the movies, why can't we do it on terrestrial telly? So they look enormously big budget. Yeah. They look absolutely immense when you see them. But in actual fact, they're not. They're all made to a shoestring, same as most television is. But yeah, very different way of approaching things. So yeah, even back then at the start of the 2000s, you know, as a production team, we were very much aware that the landscape was changing when it came to broadcasting and production and things like that. So yeah, I mean, the Time Team would come back mainly, actually, I think, through the Facebook group. Like you say, it's fan-driven now. But it'd be nice to see. I mean, our connection to the Time Team, basically, was that most of the experts that appeared for them also appeared for us. So the infrastructure, if you like, the backing behind us, we still had the Time Team stamp, the Time Team vibe going on there. And then there was that sort of crossover with contributors. But I never appeared on the Time Team. I never crossed over as presenter. And Tony never appeared on our show either. But there you go.
Yes.
So it's a shame, really, because most people don't realise I've actually got Baldrick's helmet from the first episode of Blackadder. Right at the end, they all go off to war at the end of that series. And he's wearing this strange-looking medieval pot helmet. You know, and I've got that. It's sat out in my storeroom because I got it from a props department many years ago. So I was hoping to meet Tony Robinson and go, there you are, there's your helmet. You're going to have that back now, you know, that you wore that on the end of Blackadder 1.
Oh, yes, the season hardly anybody remembers apart from hardcore fans, it would seem, Al.
Yeah, apparently, because Blackadder's not quite the same character in that. It's a different Blackadder to the ones we know and love. just ask you. That was a really useless piece of trivia. I don't know what on earth you're going to do with that, but there you go.
Like that.
So if anybody out there, you know, wants to make me bids and offers on Blackadder's original, on Baldrick's original helmet, you know, or if Tony Robinson's listening and he wants it back, by all means, let me know.
We'll see what we can do, and we'll charge a small fee for facilitating
handling fee. They can contact you and then come through you.
So I know, Mark, obviously, with your latest book, touching on crystal skulls, which we'll dive into shortly, I know that obviously you've written several books. You've covered Celtic myths and legends and history and things like that before, as well as diving into another famous British legend, Robin Hood. So obviously, when you cover your love of this subject, it's very interesting how certain influences or the direction you approach it can sort of send you off into different paths. So obviously, where you is one of those areas where a lot of people wouldn't really sort of consider it to have a real historical value, which is a bit strange because Britain, most places, you can go 10 miles, dig something, and you'll find all kinds of stuff. But
yeah,
so for you, how was it that you kind of drifted into this path in your early writing career in regards to the subjects that you were covering there, Mark?
Well, your question actually contains the answer, because the first three books that I've got in print, which I did in the 1990s, started off as a joke, because they're actually called Celtic Warrington and Other Mysteries. And everybody was like, but there isn't a Celtic Warrington. You haven't got any archaeology. You know, you live in Cheshire, for goodness sake. You know, how are you going to get away with the book? In fact, I went to the museum. I asked a guy in the museum, I said, you know, what kind of archaeology have we got around here? You know, and he's like, oh, I don't think there is anything around here. And I said, but, you know, you've got Roman here and Iron Age here. And he's like, well, you know, you want to have a go at writing a book, have a go at writing a book. And, you know, if you get one, you'll get one. Anyway, in actual fact, I've got three books that are centered on just, you know, mid-Mersey Valley, if you like, just this area. And there was at the time a deal for a fourth one, but sadly the publisher's passed away. So I've got a lot of notes for the fourth one. But the three that are actually in print, Celtic Warrington 1, 2 and 3, that's the numbers, which are done geographically. They look at the area sort of as a circle and break it up. They cover a vast amount of archaeology, but it's mostly only the ancient stuff coming up to medieval times. So when you look at that, you think, wow, you know, there's three books, and they're proper serious books, you know, they're not tiny, that are just out of that one little area, central mid-Mersey Valley. And there's more to come. You know, I mean, I could have gone perhaps to book five or even more. There's so much archaeology here that people just didn't know anything about. So like I say, implicit in the question is the answer. The answer is nobody really knew what was here. There didn't seem to be anything here. So the obvious thing for me as an archaeologist living in this area was to try and fill that gap in, which in the 1990s, it did. It filled the gap in. I mean, literally, you had sites and monuments records at the Borough Council Planning Department had these books on the shelf because they were the only reference books that they could refer to for location, you know. But so that's the first three books that I wrote. And then I moved on from that to the disappearing Ninth Legion, which the Ninth Legion obviously is connected to York, but also it's connected to Chester. Yes. So it feeds one into the other. And I was heavily involved in the archaeology in Chester, especially the amphitheatre when we were making Lost Treasures. So huge, huge links there. So that was the next book. The next logical book was to do the Disappearing Ninth Legion, which I actually co-authored with another friend of mine who was an expert in that particular subject. So he supplied me with a big stack of notes and I wrote the book. So that's the Disappearing Ninth Legion. From there came the television series, because ITV Granada picked up on the Celtic Warrington books. As soon as we started doing the TV series, I thought, hang on a minute, there's a little bit more mileage here. As we were doing it, I was aware of the existence of the Robin Hood legends. Because we were doing the series, we were going across York, we were filming, and I was looking at Robin Hood and I was thinking, you know, nobody's actually done a proper definitive evidence-based book on Robin Hood based on what we've got. And there was so much nonsense being talked about it. So I thought, you know what, I'm going to make this the next project. I'm going to have a go at this. Now, at the same time, in the background, I mean, for many, many years, I mean, like 44 years now, I've been writing a King Arthur book, which I think now is ready for publication. But I've written the Robin Hood book in the same format as the King Arthur book's been written. So it was just like a side project to another project. But the publishing world is quite odd. Books don't always come out in the order that they're written. So actually, Robin Hood's ended up coming out before the King Arthur one, because that hasn't come out yet. So that's how I got interested in the Robin Hood thing. As we said when we were chatting before we came on air, if anybody wants to search that book out, be aware that the title is Robynhoode. It's the life and times of the real Robynhoode. So if you go and search for that online, you'll get it straight away if you put that in, or my name in association with that, you'll get it. So once I'd finished doing that, somebody then came to me and went, oh, Robin Hood, that's got something to do with the Green Man, hasn't it? And I'm like, well, actually, no, it hasn't really. And this guy was like, yeah, it is. It's, you know, it's Jack in the Green and all that. And I'm like, no, that's not really where we're coming from with the Green Man. So another publisher actually contacted me and said, can you do, you know, Revealing the Green Man, which is the book that's out there now, as a project for us? And I said, well, yeah, I've been going around doing talks on it for like 10 years or something. So why not? So I sat down, I actually wrote it in one go. And that's probably in terms of readability and, you know, the way it flows, probably the first of a new generation of books that are not chunky. They're not fact driven. They kind of just flow. That one flows, you know, and that has been a bestseller. I mean, that made it into the Amazon bestsellers, excuse me. So that one's well worth looking out for. That's Revealing the Green Man. And then again, excuse me, again, out of that, the same publisher contacted me and said, can you write a book, you know, now that we're in lockdown, something that will be pertinent to coming out of the pandemic. So I wrote Crystal Skulls and Human Heads. I sent it into the publisher. Didn't realize the publisher had changed hands, sold the company to somebody else in the meantime. And the somebody else got back to me and went, what's this? it's a follow-up to Revealing the Green Man. And they went, well, we didn't ask for this. You know, it doesn't really sit anywhere in our catalogue. And I was like, but you did ask for it. And, you know, there was a bit of a ding-dong. We swapped emails. I tried to rewrite the end of it to suit them. It wasn't going anywhere. Yeah. So then I'm sat here and I'm thinking, but this is a really good book. You know, it's a great follow-up to The Green Man. It could be a bestseller. It's, you know, it's written in the same format. I thought, oh, you know, who can I possibly go and do this book with? And I was in a similar situation to this now, as with yourself, in an interview with some guys for a metal detecting program. And this metal detecting guy said, oh, I know somebody. He does UFO books. It's this guy called Philip Mantle. You want to contact him? He might be interested in this, because the last chapter in the book, you know, was called Alien Heads. So I contacted Philip and he took one look at the book and he went, yeah, this is it. This is a goer. We'll have this. Yeah, we'll publish this straight away. So very, very quickly. I mean, it was ridiculously quick because the book was formatted. The photographs were already in it. Everything was done from start to finish. I think it took about 3 weeks to get it onto Amazon. We were actually moving faster than Amazon could actually move. You know, we had it uploaded and ready to go before we even had the audio version of it done. So that was incredibly successful. I've got to say, hats off to Philip. He can really go at it when he wants to. What a rock and roll publisher. So that's how that came about. That came out as a kind of a ray of mystery and a ray of history and a bit of the paranormal in there. There's archaeology, there's archaeoscience. And then at the end of the book, there's a bit of a message for the future, you know, that says, you know, we can do better. We can get there. We can make it out of all of this that we've been through. So that's kind of the post-pandemic book. And like I say, the next one, book number 8, will hopefully be the King Arthur book, because that's in a similar position now to where Crystal Skulls was. It's ready to go. You know, if a publisher contacts me and says, yeah, we'll do this King Arthur book for you, no problem, I can say, right, there you go. Ready to go. Print it immediately. Upload that. So, yeah, so if anybody out there is listening to this, I mean, I'd love a UK publisher. There's a couple of major contributors to the book as well, some of the reviews I've had. I mean, everybody in Arthur knows John Matthews. Yeah. John Matthews is an amazing guy. He's written a little bit at the beginning. He actually endorses the book. So it's, you know, it's no mean feat. It's quite an amazing book. It's quite big. You know, it's not a throwaway book. It's a bit like the Robin Hood one. It's got a little bit of substance to it. But yeah, I'd like to put that one out next. So yeah, so there's 7 of them out there in print. And that's the next one. That's the longest advert I think I've ever done for.
You did very well, Mark. I'm very impressed, sir.
Yeah, there you go. How's that for a plug? Well, you can tell Philip when you speak to him next that I gave it a jolly good plug.
I mean, for me, my first source of exposure to the subject of Crystal Skulls, as I think for most people here in the UK, is obviously the infamous beginning to the wonderful Arthur C. Clarke series, which features, I believe, was it's the Mitchell Hedges skull, isn't it? That one of the most infamous archaeological alleged discoveries. I mean, that whole story is a bit of a mess, to say the least, Mark.
Yeah. Yeah, I had a lot of trouble wading through the nonsense with that one. In terms of original documentation, you've got to go back a long way. I think it was found in the 1930s. So to try and get hold of anything that's close to date is difficult. Arthur C. Clarke was the 70s. There is some written material from the 60s. There's some from the 1950s. And then there's Mitchell Hedges' own records, which I think come from the 1940s. Yeah. I think they're just after the Second World War, sorry. So the reason the picture's muddied is because obviously we were at war from whatever it was, 38, 39 through to 45. And I think the skull was found, I think, in 1932 or 33 in Belize. a Banton, it was found. So, yeah, difficult to get any background on that. But I am inclined to stick with Anna, because Anna was the finder. And in archaeology, you know, the person that finds something is your primary source. You go back to them in the absence of anything, you know, archaeological or whatever. You know, right to her death, I think she only died in 2007. She absolutely stuck to the same story. The details never changed. The story never changed. And the Mitchell Hedges School's interesting because it's the only one to have been really, really subjected to examination under an electron microscope. They've gone into it. It's the only one to be anatomically correct as well, with a separate jaw. And they've looked at it and they just can't work out how the thing was made. My own feelings are that whoever carved it, you know, carved it from a solid block, made a fantastic job of it. I mean, phenomenal job of it. And then spent hundreds and hundreds of years handling it, polishing it, you know, with dirt on your fingers and shining it up with grit and gravel and rubbing it with cloth. And, you know, it was obviously in circulation, and that's taken all of the markings off. You know, there's no way of telling how it was made. So I was talking to somebody the other day about this, and they asked me how many original, real, genuine skulls do I think are out there. Well, archaeologically, surprisingly, there's only two. There's only two that there are any records for. One in the ballpark at Coba, which is in the book. It's a milky white one. It's set in the floor of the ballpark. And then there's another one, a small handheld one, which came from a village just outside Mexico City. And they're not giving too many details away about that one because they want to protect the finds. Site. But actually, there's three, because I would stick my neck out and I would say that the Skull of Doom, this Mitchell Hedges one, I would say that that's probably a genuine one. Yeah, I'm going to stick my neck out and say that.
I think that's one of the refreshing things about your book, Mark, because, like I say, this subject can really raise the hackles of people in a variety of subjects, to say the very least, be they UFOlogists, be they archaeologists, be they biologists, be they historians. It seems to really annoy a lot of people across a lot of things. However, I was pleasantly surprised when I saw that you were of the opinion, which I think anybody, if you dive into this subject with a balanced viewpoint and look at it, as we should always look at things, we're coming at it with a skeptical slant, without being biased, but you've the burden of proof is on the discoverer, not the person saying, well, I'm not sure it's real. It was refreshing to see, because there are thousands of these things out there now.
Yeah, that's the problem. Basically the book, the probably the best thing that the book does is it tells you how, in theory anyway, to establish whether you're looking at one that would qualify as being real. Even some of the people that have collected these skulls have over years developed their own view of how to say whether they're real or not. At the moment, they're experimenting with ways to date stone. They think they're going to be able to do it using water loss. This is not actually in the book. It's something that's developed subsequent to that. But I couldn't put it in the book because it's not a tried and tested formula yet. They think that the exposed surface of stone loses water. So if you know what the water content of rock is before it's cut, you can work out how long it'll take to dry out, which gives you an approximate date. So if nothing else, it'll tell you if it's old or it's not old. But they haven't applied that to any of the skulls yet, so I couldn't really put it in the book. But the list is things like, is it life size? I mean, that's a good place to start. How big is it? So all these billions of these tiny little crystal skulls out there, none of them are likely to be real unless they're found in a secure, archaeologically documented context like the one in Mexico, outside Mexico City. Then they're just never going to be, you know, anything more than ornaments. But once they start getting bigger, once they start, you know, looking about the size of a small child or bigger, because I've got one that's sort of in that category, then you're starting to get serious, because it takes time to do them. The second qualification, though, is despite the fact that they're that size, they definitely need to be handmade. Yes. If they're machine made, if there's tool marks on them, you know, of any kind of machinery, even rotating spinning discs or whatever that they've used to grind these things down, then chances are they're not real. So that would then rule them out. So that takes down your hundreds of thousands of these modern ones. It takes it down to a very small handful that are actually handmade. And the one I've got's handmade. A lot of the ones in the museums are, in quotes, handmade, and then the Mitchell Hedges one and these other archaeological ones, they're all handmade because we know the techniques that were used in South America archaeologically for producing these things. And then you've got to look at them and you've got to think, how do I decide whether they're old or not? Well, then you've got to look at things like artistic design, the way they're made. How primitive is that manufacturing process? Is there any dirt or any deposits or anything trapped in the cracks? How worn are they? How polished are they? And then it almost becomes archaeological instinct as to whether you think they're old or not, because you can't obviously date the stone. But if all those factors are there, if you've got all those ducks in line, then chances are you are looking at something that is really old. Unfortunately, though, by that analysis, almost all the skulls that are in museums, like the one in the British Museum, there's some in museums in France and various other places in the world, some in America, all of them have got tool marks on them. So the oldest they can possibly be is 250 to 300 years. The guy that sold a lot of them, the guy who was a dealer in Paris called Boban, I believe, he sold a lot of them in the Victorian times going into the early sort of 1900s. He believed them to be real because everything else he sold came from South America and everything else he sold was real. So why would his skulls not be? I mean, he genuinely believed them to be real. And theoretically, they should exist. They should be an object that the Aztecs and Mayans were manufacturing because of what they believed and their systems in religion and ways of life. You would expect to find them. So, a bit of a mystery. So again, age-wise, it depends if you want to define it as real. The one I've got, I think, probably is one that was manufactured sort of.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn. But hurry, these offers won't last forever. Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
Around about Columbus going into Cortez, so you're looking at kind of late 1400s, early 1500s, because it was probably manufactured and then handed to a European or hidden at that point. It's got that kind of a background to it. So mine probably is real in inverted commas. It's an old one, but that's how you identify them.
And it's fascinating because I'm one of those people. I find these things both deeply creepy, but also stunningly beautiful because they are marvelous objects regardless. And I know there's some people can feel very sort of put out by skulls. I have to say I have several skulls. I don't own a crystal one, Mark, but I have different types. Not any real one. You know, I've not got a collection of human heads in my basement around.
Hey, don't laugh. As an archaeologist, I've had quite a few skulls knocking around over the years. In fact, crystal wise, I think I've got two crystal skulls at the moment. I've got a rose quartz, I've got the crystal skull, the clear quartz one I've got, and then I've also got this marvelous resin copy of the Mitchell Hedges one, which is quite nice. So they're all going up to the Awakening Conference at Blackpool in June. I think it's in about the 24th or 25th or 23rd and 24th of June. They're all going to be on display up there. So if people want to see those, and the organisers have got a couple of surprises as well. They've got a few archaeological bits and another skull that they've managed to bring from South America. So that's going to be interesting. So if people want to see them, get yourself onto Awakening in Blackpool.
Yeah, fantastic. Well, certainly that's first-hand viewings of them.
Yeah, I'm actually there curating it as well. So if you want to come and have a chat with me, I'm giving it a plug, you see, on radio. If you want to come and talk with me, come and find me at Awakening. So I'm there all 3 days, Friday, Saturday and Sunday.
Oh, brilliant. Fantastic. I mean, it is something that I think, like I was saying, really does fire up people. And I think it's one of those things when we talk about history and civilizations and artifacts, because as you're saying there, some people aren't claiming that these are thousands of years old. These are fairly recent in the pantheon of historical artifacts, like as you were referring to there.
Yeah.
400-500 years is, you know, it's a hell of a time when you think about the USA didn't exist outside of, for the tribes and the natives people that lived there, but for anybody else outside of that area, they'd no idea it was there. And obviously, you know, you'd got tribes who were in the lower part of the North American continent who probably had no
idea. Yeah, I mean, some people would dispute the fact that the Europeans didn't know that America was there, because Archaeologists, there's not just that, there's all sorts. There's Scottish knights that have gone across there in the 1200s. They've got Phoenician, they've got Egyptian, they've got Ogam, they've got a Roman shipwreck, they've got, honestly, a Bronze Age, Iron Age, prehistoric. They've got absolutely shed loads of stuff out there. There's even one Native American tribe who were white. It's pretty odd, the connections. But like you say, the American archaeological community didn't really want that sort of thing broadcast. Oh, look, I've just gone and done it.
Well, it's one of those things. I mean, I know a couple of American archaeologists, and one of the things I've always been confused by, Mark, is that when you look at North American archaeology, there seems to be a cutoff point where a lot of establishments don't seem to care what predates Native Americans and the First Nations people. And I find this really odd, because there's been so many conversations in regards to when they've spoken to these people, where they've said, what are these artifacts, these mounds, whatever? And a lot of them, for them, in their oral tradition, they were, well, they've always been here. They were here when we arrived. And it's almost as if, as we often find sometimes when it comes to history and archaeology, Mark, you may shed more light on this. Sometimes when we're dealing with the academia aspect of this, there seems to be a line in the sand where it's, well, we're not bothered what happened beforehand. We know the point we want to start at, and we're interested in everything after that. And I, for someone with a deep interest and a thirst for knowledge, get really frustrated when we have things that somebody somewhere decides this is the starting point for things we're going to know. Because for me, I'm one of those people that I find it fascinating that different cultures have similar legends. I find it very hard to believe that people all around the world had the same dream about dragon, for example.
Well, and, you know, the list goes on. Pyramids, you know, they're all over the world. Certain types of architecture all over the world. The guys with the elongated skulls, the guys with the extended heads all over the world. Stone circles, stone monuments, all at the same point in prehistory all over the world. You know, Bronze Age technology all over the world. You know, it's just the list is endless, just goes on and on and on. You know, knowledge about shipbuilding and travel, and it just, you know, it's quite obvious that people talk to people talk to people, and, you know, the planet wasn't quite as disconnected as people imagined in the past. I think, to sort of answer the question in there about, you know, there being lines in the sand, there used to be this old thing where in archaeology and history and whatnot, you couldn't challenge somebody's career if it was going to destroy that career. But the other side of that coin is that a lot of archaeologists and historians have got this tendency to live to really old age. So it was like it was taking 50 to 70 years for information to get out, you know, for people to you can't stand up and tell somebody they're wrong because it's going to destroy the career. So, I mean, the first person to really do that, to stick the head out of the foxhole, I think, was Erik von Daniken. You know, he was actually way out there. He was saying, you know, this isn't what we're saying it is. This is something else. This is something else. This is something else. I mean, I don't agree with everything Erik has come out with, but at least he got the ball rolling. So, you know, you've got to give him credit for that. He really did kick the beehive, you know. And then ever since then, people have been doing the same thing. So now with the internet, obviously with 21st century technology, stuff gets out so fast, and it gets out right across the globe. So what is essentially the American, you know, political, economic and career line in the sand has largely disappeared. And it's not a line in the sand, like you say, that the Native Americans had. You know, they already knew that there was older stuff. I was reading an article somewhere now online about them recently discovering footprints, fossilized human footprints in parts of America. And you're looking at 23,000 BC.
Yeah.
And now they're actually admitting that they've got them. You know, these footprints are there. There's photographs online. So I'm thinking, wow, you know, we've come a tremendously long way here. And also there's DNA analysis has been done that seems to indicate that there was an influx of people just after the Ice Age coming across onto the American continent from the direction of Europe, which makes perfect sense, because most migrations seem to start in the east and then they head west. So if you just keep going west, eventually you're going to finish up in America.
Yeah.
And that's precisely what DNA is showing us, you know, even down to the book itself, the guys with these elongated heads, their DNA seems to track back to the Middle East. So even though they're in America, even though they're in South America, they do seem to have DNA markers in common with stretched heads, you know, going back in the other direction. going back towards the east. So these steps forward now are changing the way we're looking at things. I think it's a good thing. I think it's fantastic. I think, you know, information needs to get out there. And it's more people need to jump on the same kind of track as I've done with, you know, crystal skulls and human heads. People need to go, right, okay, there's disinformation, disinformation, disinformation. Get it all factual, get it all researched, you know, get your ducks in line, get it belt and braces, get it out there and start producing books like that, that do reveal, you know, solid linked up connections with the information that's coming out now. More people need to do it.
Absolutely. I think it's one of those things, as someone that loves history, I find it incredible that we are supposed to expect that when the Greeks got to the head of the Mediterranean, they just thought, oh, we're not going out there, we're going to turn back round. And the same, you know, I mean, I still can't believe that people don't look at the exploration powers of the Vikings, because, I mean, at the end of the day, are we expecting that they only went downwards to the north coast of Africa?
Yeah.
And didn't go? We know they got to Greenland. We know they got to Iceland because we're there. There is evidence that they're in North America. And I still find it remarkable that people just don't accept it.
I went over to Morocco. I've been there 3 years on the bounce. I went to Marrakesh and did the whole sort of Moroccan thing. And out there, you know, they've got direct links to the Vikings. The, you know, the tribal jewellery and stuff like that is extremely Norse, or vice versa. You know, the Norse picked that up. But, you know, the Canary Islands, the king of the Canary Islands had Viking mercenaries as an army. So it's just the public can't get the head around the idea of having, you know, a Viking standing there in the Sahara Desert talking to a guy who looks like an Arab on a camel. You know, they can't get their head around that. Same with the Greeks. I mean, the Greeks got all the way across to India. They were fighting Indian armies that had elephants. So the idea of, you know, somebody that looks like Spartacus, you know, legging it across a river, attacking elephants coming the other way, people just can't get their heads around that. But it's real. You know, it's real history. It actually happened. It's there in the records. And the archaeology's there to back it up, you know. Fantastic point. Incredible point.
Yeah.
It's more things like that that need to be revealed. And it is true the world over. The one that always pops my head, and it, again, getting back to the book, so we are on topic, is I have a look at Akhenaten and his daughters and his sons, which is like Sankare, Tutankhamun, all that sort of thing.
Yeah,
because they've all got these elongated heads. But when you actually look at them and you look at the DNA, the highest hits for that DNA anywhere on planet Earth today is here in Britain. Mm-hmm. So they're British. They're Central European Celts. That's what they are by DNA definition, which does explain why they didn't get on particularly well with the rest of Egypt. And eventually their dynasty kind of got cut off. But prior to Akhenaten, there were actually Celtic warriors stationed in Egypt as an army. So you can understand that you know, people from the army expanded, bred with the local population, whatever. You know, they got more and more numerous till eventually they were powerful enough to take over rulership. They only got one shot at it with Akhenaten and his dynasty. And then one of his daughters, Meretaten, who flees the persecutions when the dynasty collapses, she finishes up coming across the southern island. And when she lands, they call her Scotia. Or Scotia. So she is actually the queen of the Scots, the Irish and the Scottish Scots. You know, there's a book called Kingdom of the Ark out there that was written in, I think, 1999. And that particular book, they actually get to the end of their investigations into this, and they do an archaeological dig on her grave in Southern Ireland. The archaeological report is there, and she's there. There's an Egyptian princess buried in full regalia, stuck under a Celtic mound in Southern Ireland. Ta-da, you know what I mean? You just can't make this stuff up.
Well, I just find it remarkable, Mark, personally, that they just presume that we are supposed to expect that these amazingly advanced ancient civilizations from Egypt to Babylon to the Roman Empire, Incas, Aztecs, wherever you go, there are incredible civilizations going back 3,000 years BC. I find it remarkable that we're supposed to expect to believe that these people were so technologically advanced for whatever reason in particular points in history that they just stayed where they were. Because I just find that nonsensical, because surely you become technologically advanced through exploration, research, cultivation. You go out into the world and you discover things. For me personally, Mark, I find it baffling that we are supposed to believe that nobody did anything till about 1400.
There's definitely been a mistake, probably by, it's probably come about since people have been looking into the evolution series, where evolution says that you start off really primitive and then you finish up more advanced. That doesn't work when you start looking at history, because the capacity, especially of these guys with the enormous heads, you know, the brain capacity, the cranial capacity of humans in the past, make them at least as good at what they do as we are, if not, you know, three or four times better. I mean, one of these guys with the enormous cranial stretched heads things, the enormous head guys, you might have somebody there that's equivalent to 3.5 Einsteins, you know, stack one on top of the other, get 10 of them in a room and, you know, you could build a pyramid in 2 minutes flat, you know, because they're super intelligent. So these guys are going to be as good at what they're doing in the past as we are now, if not better. Because they may be doing it a different way, and that different way may be better than our way.
I think it's interesting because, you know, when we look at these civilizations from around, I mean, this is the other thing. Maybe it's this modern snobbery or this kind of created perception that everybody in the past were, as you referred to there, primitive in some way, Mark. We may not agree with their religious practices or some of their beliefs. But when you're talking about, you know, civilizations like the Incas who had a phenomenal understanding of the night sky and how the universe revolved and things like this, and then you look at 1,000 years ago, these people probably had a more basic understanding of the night sky than most people do these days. Now, maybe that's because as we've become more technologically advanced in the modern era, people look for information rather than learn it.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
Yeah,
they tend to, they don't want to know something because you don't need to know. One of the most infuriating things I hear is people say, oh, Google it. Well, don't Google it, learn it.
The saying is that people are now looking down instead of looking up, which is precisely what they're doing. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's remarkable when you look at things, challenges that we come across through amazing civilizations like the Chinese dynasties and everything they achieved.
Yeah.
Yet they had real problems with the construction of glass.
Yeah.
Obviously. Something that you dive into, because obviously glass is something, and silica especially,
yeah,
it's been with us throughout history and how certain civilizations. And yet they were still able to make incredible advances in other areas.
Oh, yeah.
And it's weird sometimes how certain civilizations, when we look back at them, there's like a big gap in their particular knowledge base.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean they're not technologically or intellectually advanced.
Or it could mean that we've just not discovered something yet.
Precisely.
I mean, the Chinese, you know, it would be amazing, wouldn't it? You know, some guy decides he's going to double glaze all his palace, you know, so he puts all the windows in and then all of a sudden, bang, somebody invents gunpowder and it takes all the windows out. So it's like, no, we're not going to have windows. Forget windows. You know, gunpowder's more useful, you know, we can...
You might have solved it.
Yeah, we can do stuff with gunpowder, but we can't do anything with windows. They keep blowing out every time you fire a cannon, you know what I mean? And then, you know, it's just, you don't know how, it does make a point that you don't know how they actually ended up using what they had, you know, and how they viewed what they had. I mean, South America, there was no use really for glass in South America because they just used obsidian, which is volcanic glass.
Yes.
You know, that's as good and it's available everywhere. So why would you bother to try melting it, you know? But that having been said, actually, I have recently encountered a crystal skull that looks like melted obsidian. So I might actually be shooting myself in the foot there. But most of it, you know, in South America is flint. You know, it's knacked obsidian and knacked flint, which is a form of silica. So, yeah, we need to look at these people in the past and not think, you know, that they perhaps didn't know about something. Maybe they did know about it, but they just didn't do with it what we're doing with it now. You know, the Egyptians, for example, it looks like they had electricity. They could get gliders up into the air. They probably had hot air balloons. There's certain evidence in areas of the Middle East that there was somebody mucking about with nuclear power because there's a lot of, you know, blasts that appear to have been destructive. But what they probably did was they looked at all this and they just thought, what can we do with it? You know, what possible use is it? What damage is it going to do to the environment? Do the benefits outweigh the destruction, the problems, you know, the positives more than the negatives? And their decision-making process was obviously different from ours. Their worldview, their viewpoint, you know, their rationale was different. But it doesn't make that difference more primitive than us. I think in a lot of cases, it makes them more advanced. You know, they were intelligent enough to realize that certain directions are better off not followed, you know, better off not pursued. You know, I mean, the Baghdad battery is a good example because, you know, about 1500, 1600 years ago, they were putting these batteries in parallel. And they were, you know, I mean, each one of them's only 3.5 volts, you know, but they were putting them in parallel in rows of like blocks of like 500. So you could just imagine there they are with all this, you know, technology. Wow, you know, we've got this power station generating so many thousand watts of electricity from vinegar. The first person to get hold of that would have just got fried. Bang, you know, good night, Vienna. So maybe it got to a point where they were like, no, this is too dangerous. We don't want to do anything with this. So it just died out. You know, they did it. They had a go with it. They gave it a try. They decided they just didn't want to carry on. I just don't think the decision-making processes were the same. So yeah, just because they don't have something doesn't mean they don't necessarily know about it. They might know about it and be better at it than us.
Yeah. I mean, often as well, history is littered with civilizations that get to a certain point. And like you say, once they overstep a certain mark, wherever they are, the world, there are things that have happened to these great things, because obviously people don't understand how somewhere like Egypt could simply collapse very quickly. It happened with the Roman Empire. Yeah, basically, they just became upset. The Greeks were the same. Chinese were probably more protected because they were quite insular, despite, you know, obviously they still had forays into sort of Western Asia and towards India and Urals and things like that, where they got that far out. But then again, you have civilizations like the Japanese who were completely insular and didn't go anywhere.
Yeah,
virtually.
Yeah.
They were one of the last habited places that was discovered in what we would call the modern era of the last 300 years. And it's remarkable that once again, that there seems to be this kind of aspect that we look at these civilizations that vanish and we sometimes say, oh, well, how could that have happened? But often it's because they've gone too far.
Yeah, that's explored in the book, actually. I think I opened it. I opened the book up with that, actually, in the first chapter. Basically, the whole principle of evolution is that you start with something that's primitive, like I say, and then it improves. Mm. You know, things get better. And as generally speaking, Western society has been sold this idea that everything's improving, everything's getting better. But as you rightly say, certainly history doesn't support that. You know, everything goes in ebbs and flows, and it gets to the point where decay sets in. And I don't think anybody anywhere really have paid enough attention to the effects of decay. Because as soon as you put that factor in, I suppose it's chaos theory, you know, as soon as you factor that in, then everything just goes to pot, because it goes in these cycles, aiming for perfection in a world which it doesn't support perfection, you know, is an impossibility. You're never, ever going to get to a point where things are, you know, absolutely bang on, 100%, that's it. I mean, anybody that's ever published a book knows that. Everybody, I think, has got this ambition to publish a book with no typographic errors. But if you have a go at it, you can't do it. I can tell you now, it cannot be done. No amount of computing, spell checking, proofreading, whatever, there will be always errors in every single book. And it's known. Mm. I mean, that's a known fact. And that is the scientific and mathematical outworking of chaos formula. That's what it is. And it's just literally inherent in absolutely everything. It's nature. It's Mother Nature. It's planet Earth itself. You cannot escape it. It is a fact of life. And, you know, there's these guys walking around, you know, these evolutionists that seem to think, you know, we're going to ascend to some kind of higher existence or whatever. But, you know, it's not being supported by reality, you know. So there is a kind of a harder side to the book as well. A lot of these, you know, fluffy kind of ideas that people have had, you know, over the last 100, 200, 300 years or whatever, a lot of those get destroyed by the logic and by the science and, you know, by the actual physicality of it all. But then the point of the book is actually the reality is more amazing. It's more special, you know, it's more important, it's more empowering, it's more spiritual. You know, the reality is far better in every way than the falsity, you know, than the, you know, the lies and the, you know, the invented nonsense that people are being fed. So that is an underlying thread that runs through the book. You know, truth is better than lie, you know, every day of the week without fail, which would be a nice kind of push. You know, that's kind of a shove, if you like, that you find on social media nowadays, and that, you know, apparently all this COVID stuff and all the rest of it, we are ascending, you know, to a higher, you know, some kind of higher plateau of human existence. You know, you know, I'm all for that. I'll back that and support it and push it all that I can. But it's all right saying that. You've got to have a way of getting there. And the way to get there is to, you know, is to out the nonsense, get the nonsense out there and get it dealt with, get rid of all the rubbish. You know, I suppose very, like you say, I touch on a few things because I do that with crystal skulls. I do it with the stretched heads. I do it with evolution. And I also do it with the moon landing and getting off planet Earth as well. All those issues are dealt with within the bounds of the book. There's definitely a thread there if you look for it. So if you like your odd conspiracy theory, buy the book.
I mean, there's several things. Carl Sagan famously said, extinction is the rule, survival is the exception. And I think there is an arrogance in humanity that we presume we are.
Yeah.
We are the prime architect of everything around us. And as we've been saying about civilizations and history, you can have all the technology in the world at that particular period of time at your fingertips. However, Mother Nature has a real record of throwing a massive spanner in the works, Mark.
Yeah.
Ice ages, earthquakes, tsunamis, volcanic eruptions.
Yeah, meteorite strikes, you know, floods.
Precisely.
Yeah, you name it. Yeah.
Cataclysmic events will override technology, whatever happens, you know. We only have to look at two horrific events that have happened this century alone. What happened, the Boxing Day tsunami back in 2004, obviously, in Japan in 2011. You know, and we're talking about the modern era, and yet thousands of people died regardless of all the technological advances, the warning systems, the ability for people to be aware of it. Obviously, the Boxing Day situation was very different because of how violent that was.
Yeah.
But you only look at Japan, they knew it was coming, and it was just simply, it just swamped that side of the country.
Yeah.
It was impossible to escape from.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the same thing could happen, actually. People are sort of waiting for a solar flare. You know, if you get a decent-sized solar flare, if the sun basically coughs, if the sun kind of goes like that, you know, it's like, there you go, all the silicon chips are gone. It'll erase data. It'll take out, you know. So even though we're looking at what is essentially a extremely high-level technology, it has still got a fragility about it. It is still fragile. Yeah. As you say, you know, this, the almighty foot of God, like you used to get on Monty Python's Flying Circus, you know, on the titles, sort of comes down out of the sky and goes, that could still happen at any moment to any of our, you know, dreams, our technology, our civilization, whatever. But again, the sort of ray of hope in the book is that, you know, we've survived this before. You know, it has happened before and we're still here. So we've still got that going for us. But, you know, it doesn't necessarily make us the top of the food chain either. You know, I mean, goodness only knows what goes on in the mind of a dolphin or an octopus or even aliens, if that's what you believe. You know, these hyper-intelligent mega beings that kind of arrive in these silver discs, you know. Who knows what goes on in heads like that? It's possible we're not the top of the food chain. Maybe we never were. I mean, the guys with the elongated skulls with the enormous, you know, brain capacity, they actually only died out in the Paracas in Peru. They only died out about 400 or 500 years ago, which is no time at all in terms of history. An enormous loss for the human race. You know, they would have been a phenomenal species. But they're gone. And there's not been any sensible investigation into what happens if you make skulls bigger. You know, there could actually there be a biological functioning supercomputer that you can create from a human brain, from a human skull. And that whole concept has just gone. It's disappeared. Well, I would put them higher than us in the food chain.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn. But hurry, these offers won't last forever. Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
They would. You know, vastly more intelligent and capable than we are. And they've only just disappeared, like yesterday in historical times. So like you say, you know, we are, if we think we're the big cheese, then we're skating on thin ice. You know, we're not really being sensible about how things work, which I suppose is the darker side of the evolutionary thing. If everyone thinks everything's getting better and you're into your evolution and, you know, oh, nothing can possibly happen, you know, we're just evolving to a higher state. that they're going to get a rude awakening if we get an asteroid or, you know, something goes wrong, which does. I mean, like you say, it can happen anywhere in the world, anytime, for any reason. I mean, I think the pandemic, that really shook a lot of people, you know, in that respect, because something that's invisible, a germ,
yes,
you know, can create that kind of havoc. I think it, now after that, the book in effect is kind of saying, you know, we need to man up, we need to face that, and perhaps we need to approach the way we live, you know, our views as a sort of a Western, the Western Hemisphere view needs to change to accommodate the fact that, you know, everything might be peachy now, everything might be great now, but we need to be aware of the fact that there's always a dark shadow waiting around, you know.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it just, well, there is a hope. We're still here.
Yes. Yeah. I'm sure. I mean, it happens though. You know, like we were saying there about cataclysmic events, you know, we only have to look 100 years ago, Mark, look at the effect that the Spanish flu had around the world. I'm not one for sort of making comparisons or a competition of deadly viruses.
Yeah.
But the Spanish flu was an extremely virulent disease that people in their millions died, you know, and obviously everybody we've all been through in the last couple of years, and as someone that had the misfortune of catching COVID after dodging it for the best part of 2 years,
yeah,
which really annoyed
me. I did the same. I had it twice. I had it once at the beginning before they knew what it was, and then got it fairly recently right at the very end. So yeah, I could be an, I okay, got the excuse it. To be annoyed twice.
So it's incredible, really, that 100 years later, all the same mistakes that seemed to happen at the beginning of that were happening again. And I was someone, as I said earlier, as someone who loves history and sees things like this. It's incredible. And like we're talking about cataclysmic events.
Yeah.
Tunguska is one of those near misses, because this is the other aspect of this, because there are things flying about in the skies above us outside of our atmosphere, Mark, which could cataclysmically calls everything on Earth to stop.
Well, yeah,
depending on where it hit, when it hit, how it hit. And Tunguska is a prime example of something that was very fortunate of where it was and when it happened.
Yeah, yeah.
Same as Krakatoa.
Oh, yeah.
That is an explosion in the Pacific that was heard in Europe.
Well, yeah,
that's how bloody loud that was. So God knows.
You're talking here about 2,000 years of that happening, and it seems we seem to get something every century. You know, like you say, Krakatoa going off, that's, you know, gave everybody a really bad day. And then coming forward, like you say, plagues, you got the bubonic plague, which was medieval. Yeah. I mean, those lessons, it's 1,000 years ago, but the lessons that came out of that started in Constantinople, spread across the whole of the, you know, medieval and crusading world. It went everywhere. It ran for hundreds of years. But nobody seemed to learn anything from the lessons that were learned from that. You know, and it keeps coming round again and round again and round again. And like you say, we just seem to, what do we do? You know, how do we respond to this? That's what history and archaeology can really offer. You know, that's what it can really offer, is experience, you know, and examples of where this has happened before. I mean, the guys with enormous stretched heads, their memory capacity must have been enormous compared to ours. So their ability to pass data on from one generation to another would have been better than ours. Hence the fact, I think, you find in the ancient world, a lot of stuff doesn't get written down because there isn't any need to write it down. You know, they have their own biological servers and ways of saving things.
Mm.
Nowadays, we'd be screwed, like you say. You know, get another one of the Tunguska asteroids coming in, you know, and it shoots across Europe at an angle, and that really would get rid of all of your data. You know, that would wipe everything, you know. You'd have all sorts of stuff going wrong. You know, like I say, these things come around every century. There's always something every century. It'd be nice to think COVID was, you know, the one for ours.
Mm.
Don't really want to be around to see anything worse. But then, like you say, you just don't know.
Absolutely.
That's a chaos formula for you, you know. You just don't know. There are things you can't calculate.
Indeed. And I think it's one of those things as well, because as we're talking about history and archaeology, one of the things that we look at, if you look at what we knew 40 years ago about human civilization, for example, the general consensus seemed to be Homo sapiens eradicated Neanderthals, and that's all there was to it.
Yeah.
Now, 40 years later, we've got Denisovans who have popped up.
Yeah.
We've got our little friends out in the Pacific, the Fluorensis.
Homo Fluorensis,
who were supposed to be myth and legend.
Oh, yeah.
And then all of a sudden we find a whole cave full of skeleton.
Yeah.
And it makes you wonder now, because as far as I'm aware, we've gone from two species of human, upright humans, that were supposed to have coexisted 40,000 years ago, which we now know essentially just interbred. And that's where Neanderthals went. We didn't kill them all. We just integrated, merged.
Yeah.
And now you look at everything else that keeps happening, because every sort of 5 years, Mark, we seem to be making these amazing discoveries that keep changing this picture.
I think in the book there's about a dozen different potential species, but I know from what I get reports and what have you, since subsequent to writing the book, they're finding different species at the rate of human species, this is, at the rate of probably one every couple of years. You know, they've got mystery races popping up now. They've only just, by the way, very, very recently, only in the last, I think, few months, they've managed to map the entire human genome now. They've been working on it for a long, long time, many, many years. They've got it all now. So that's going to enable them to start to unpick the DNA that they find on a lot of other remains, and they'll start to find more. I'm convinced. They've actually called it now this Lord of the Rings type world, you know, where, like you say, you've got hobbits, so, you know, you've got your tiny people, Homo floresiensis. Presumably that's going to end up running all the way through to giants, because by giants, I mean, you've got people like Robert Wadlow over here. That's a giant. But then you've also got other giants that are recorded as growing up to 20 foot, 30 foot, whatever. I'm sure the remains for those are there as well. We just haven't got them under a DNA analysis yet. But I'm convinced they're there, because they're there in all the other species on planet Earth. You know, you get tiny little palm cats that'll sit in the palm of your hand that come from, like, the jungle, all the way up to things like ligers, which are lion and tigers combined, the size of a horse. You know, it's the same for all the other genetic species on planet Earth. So why wouldn't it be the same for us? You know, it's just perfectly logical.
As with anything, giganticism can occur in any species. And it's one of those things that I think, when we now look at what we know in regards to the various strands that have spread out over centuries and millennia, it's clear that, like I say, what if you spoke to somebody about this subject 40 years ago now, Mark, they'd think you were just talking magic, because they'd be like, well, what are you on about? And you'd be like, well, we know for him, like the Denisovians were just found by accident in a cave.
Czechoslovakia.
And that's, you know, these are things that have only recently started to be developing. So we know next to nothing about these things.
Mm.
So for me, once, you know, as we've been talking about this whole aspect of it, it's frustrating that we presume that civilizations did use things, because we just haven't found it yet.
Yeah.
And therefore that means they didn't have it. Whereas I find that peculiar in most aspects of life, because the absence of evidence doesn't mean it didn't happen. We just haven't found it yet.
Yeah.
Nobody's suggesting that 2,000 years ago people had aeroplanes, for God's sakes, but
some people believe.
But it doesn't necessarily mean that they didn't use things just because we haven't found them. And it just amazes me when you have civilizations like the Egyptians, who were so well versed with irrigation, they turned Egypt into a garden, for God's sake.
Yeah, South Americans did the same. Yeah, with the chinampas, they could grow indefinite food using the bacteria from the bottom of the lake. You know, they just stuck it on a chinampa and off you go. It just grows, you know, food forever. And that's proper science as well. So they knew things back then that we're only just, like you say, rediscovering now. You've got things like the Saqqara glider as well. Speaking of Egypt, that's a glider. Yes. It's a functioning, you know, model toy of Horus, the bird. But it's a glider. It's a functioning glider. So that means if they made a model of one, does it mean that they were capable of building a full-size one? Then you've got all those little South American bird figures that look like jet aircraft. You know, they're turning up all over the place. They turn up in mysteries books and what have you. And then, of course, in India, I think they're called the Viracochas, which are these flying machines that are used by the gods. That seems to point to some form of air travel in ancient mythology, going back into the BC period for India. So, as you say, different races at different times have taken the forefront and risen up in terms of technology. But, you know, back to what I was saying about gunpowder and blowing windows out, you know, in China, at the end of the day, somebody in India might have built an aircraft and, you know, gone flying in it and thought, hey, this is amazing, this, you know. They've built half a dozen of them, maybe even a dozen of them. The first couple of aircraft to go wrong and crash, they might have just thought, you know, we're not going to do this anymore. This is a bad idea. You know, it's not safe. And then at that point, the technology stops.
Yeah.
You've then got to think, well, how many times did that happen? How many times did they arrive at a position where they took the decision not to go on any further with that? Then you get into this position. Well, when you get the last of something, have we actually found it? Have we discovered at what point they stopped?
Yeah.
That most of those discoveries are accidental. You know, if they only built like a dozen aircraft, you know, and half of them crashed and, you know, they might have decided to roll one into a cave somewhere and wall it up. You've got one item there, one artifact that could solve all the mysteries, you know, that we've got. But where the hell is it? You know, the world is a big place. It's an enormous place. So occasionally you do get these ooh parts turning up. You know, things do turn up and really cause a headache for traditional history and archaeology, which I think is fabulous. You know, like I say, get it on the online, get it on the internet, get photographs out there, do a proper job, get it analysed, get it reported and get it out there so people can, you know, see it and form an opinion on it and we'll go forward, you know, in knowledge. That's kind of my way of approaching it.
Absolutely. I mean, before we sort of wrap it up, I think that one of the best examples of perception that's changed in the last 2 or 3 years, Mark, is cave art.
Whoa, yeah.
Yeah. Now they've suddenly realised that actually, if you light a fire in the cave, the pictures move. So now we are now looking at things that are thousands of years old that we just thought were really nice pictures on the wall. And then sometimes people thought, because I know there was a theory that they were saying, well, some of these that have got these lines through them, it's because people wanted to cover it up or it was like ancient graffiti or abuse. And now all of a sudden it's, well, actually, it makes the pictures move.
Yeah,
it's entertainment.
It's an early form of animation. You move the light source and it creates, shadows and animation. I mean, they've got even further from that. I think Paul Devereaux did a book on archaeoacoustics, looking at that side of it. And some of the caves where these things are, if you make the right noise in the right place, you end up with the noise of the animal coming back. So you've then got, you know, the animation, the illustration, the technology, you've got the audio and the sound aspect. And you're thinking, wow, you know, these guys are only one step away from, you know, moving pictures, for goodness sake. And like I say, these things are not just tens of thousands of years old. Some of them are hundreds of thousands of years old. You're going back to, you know, the Ice Age, the breaks in the Ice Ages, and in some cases, all the way back to caves where there were Neanderthals and Denisovans, etc. Mm-hmm. You know, it seems to be something that's running all the way through. Well, I, you know, don't get me onto prehistoric technology. If you get me onto that, we'll be here all night. I'm switching off in the early hours if you get me onto that. Yeah. I'll tell you what, if you want a bit of an exciting, you know, wow moment in terms of prehistoric technology, just go and look at rattlebacks. Rattlebacks are these bone things that are shaped a bit like a boomerang, and they're found in an awful lot of prehistoric caves. If you flick them in one direction, they spin and spin and spin, and they just keep spinning forever. You know, I think I'm right in saying they go anti-clockwise. If they're going anti-clockwise, they just keep going. So they're almost like indefinite energy generators. They just keep spinning forever. You flick them the other way, you flick them anti-clockwise, they spin a couple of times, and then they turn around and start going back the other way. So they let it go in one direction. They're called rattlebacks, and they have no idea why these prehistoric guys made them. But the aerodynamics that are involved and the friction principles and the mathematics involved in making them is absolutely off the Richter scale, absolutely off the chart. And they don't even know what these things were for. But just if anybody wants to, you know, have a sort of a wow moment, archaeological wow moment, go check out rattlebacks. Rattlebacks are just, you know, absolutely amazing things.
Well, I think the overriding thing is, as we've been talking about the end of the world and death and destruction on a cataclysmic scale, Mark, I think we take away from the fact that the book is quite a positive way of looking at it and reaffirming your connection with the people and the world around you. And I think the overriding aspect of this book is about opening your mind, moving forwards, and not just presuming that things are going to get better because that's what we've been told.
Yeah.
It has to be pushed, it has to be protected, and it has to be developed.
And I think most importantly, it's got to be done right. I think that's one of the big keys that came out of the book is the more I looked at what had gone wrong in the past and the way, you know, like you say, certain civilizations, certain races perhaps hadn't gone down the way they should have gone down, the correct road to lead to the, you know, the correct sort of position. I think the book itself emphasizes that we need the information, the solidity, the truth, you know, the practicality, the validity, you know, it's all got to be there. You move forward on that principle, you can't really go wrong. You know, even if we make allowances for what can go wrong in terms of our environment and all the rest of it, you're almost saying, well, you know, if common sense prevails, then we'll be ready. We'll be prepared, you know, for whatever comes, simply because we're living in a world that is truthful to the point of almost being blunt. I'm not saying we can't have all the magical side of it. And, you know, we're imaginative, we're spirit beings, we're, you know, we're creative, and all that is just as equally as important. But I think in terms of the solidity, we have in recent years become a bit baggy in that department, you know, a bit lacking. And I think, yes, the book is very shoot, it's a duck, it's very matter of fact, but yes, it's very positive at the end. I would like people to take away, you know, perhaps a way of dealing with things, you know. There's a methodology there in the way that the book approaches things. So, yeah, as I've said it before, it's a tiny little book with an enormous story to tell. That's what it is. How's that for an advert? Go out and buy that book.
Yeah. Sometimes the best books usually are, yeah, Mark. Yeah. Sometimes the best are. So where can everybody get hold of a copy of it, Mark, and keep up to date with your work, my friend?
Right. I keep things really, really, really simple. Okay. So if you want to get hold of any of the books that I've written, this one included, get yourself onto Amazon, type my name in, and preferably the title of the book, but it's not so important nowadays. Type my name in, all of them, every single one of them will be available on Amazon. They're all there. So go and get them, you know, buy those books. That's the adverts out of the way. If you want to come and find me, I'm equally as simple to find, certainly in this country, possibly internationally. Find me on Facebook. Come and find me on Facebook. I have an open Facebook page, an open Facebook site. Everything I do, everything I am, all the photographs, you know, the books, the work I do with the bands, music and all that, production, television, everything. Sooner or later, it's going to end up on the Facebook page. So, you know, friend me. If I like the look of you, I'll accept you. If your name's Fifi Trixabelle and your picture's a rainbow, then forget it, because I won't friend you, because I won't know who you are. But, you know, if you're a real person, come and find me and send me messages on Messenger. Good way to communicate. And then if we want to get technical, we want to do anything else, once I know who you are, I'll pass on email details and stuff. So really the starting point is Facebook. So there you go. On the one hand, product, it's Amazon. Me, it's Facebook.
Brilliant. Thank you, Mark. Well, thank you again for a mind-expanding and thought-provoking conversation. Thank you for entertaining me with your wonderful new book. I really look forward to seeing your King Arthur. I hope I get the opportunity to speak to you about that subject, because to be honest, King Arthur is something I've ignored for a very long time. And I've only just started delving into it. And as you say, as we were talking about Robin Hood, God, that's a mess of a...
Oh, it's just... Yeah. So, yeah. I mean, I've got to say, by the United States president of the Worldwide Robin Hood Society said that that was the best book on Robin Hood ever written. So if you want to cut through all the nonsense, go out and buy Life and Times of the Real Robin Hood. It's a belter. And going back to King Arthur, you know, whether or not the book gets published, if you want a radio show on that, give me a shout.
Brilliant. I'll hold you to that, Mark. Mark, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you very much for having me. It's been a real pleasure to be here.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn. But hurry, these offers won't last forever. Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed Sponsored Jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Tired of trying diet after diet without results? Mochi Health offers a long-term weight loss solution personalized to your needs. Our board-certified obesity doctors and registered dietitians provide expert guidance to help you succeed. Eligible patients can access custom-formulated GLP-1 medication at an affordable set price delivered monthly. Take our free quiz at joinmochi.com and use code AUDIO40 for $40 off your first month. That's joinmochi.com.